From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
4% of the 12,000 radio stations in the United States are owned by minorities. 4%! 1% of the 1,700 television stations. And of course, while owners don't interfere on a daily basis in the working of any broadcast or journalistic organization, they have a huge say in who gets hired, especially at the top-level jobs.
Today, in our Independence Day weekend special, we'll hear from our own Juan Gonzalez on media, racism, and the role of third world journalists. Then we go back to 1852 to hear Frederick Douglass's historic July 4th oration.
Fellow citizens, pardon me. Allow me to ask, why am I called upon to speak here today? What have I or those I represent to do with your national independence?
Today, Frederick Douglass is read by Bernard White. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, our Independence Weekend special. Sunday is the 4th of July. While many in America hang flags, attend parades, watch fireworks, Independence Day is not a cause of celebration for all. For Native Americans, it's a bitter reminder of colonialism, which brought disease, violence, genocide, and the destruction of their culture and way of life. For African Americans, Independence Day did not extend to them. While white colonists were declaring their freedom from the crown, that liberation was not shared with millions of Africans captured, beaten, and separated from their families and forced into brutal slavery thousands of miles from home. Today we turn to one of the most powerful voices of the abolition movement, Frederick Douglass, born a slave in Maryland in 1818. As a young boy taught to read by slaveholder Sophia Auld, it was a dangerous and radical act that changed his destiny. Frederick Douglass escaped from slavery in the 1830s, became a leader in the growing campaign against slavery through lectures and his anti-slavery newspaper, the North Star. During an Independence Day observance in 1852, Frederick Douglass delivered one of his most powerful speeches against slavery in Rochester, New York. This is a dramatic reading by Bernard White of Pacifica radio station WBAI of Frederick Douglass's historic 4th of July oration.
Fellow citizens, pardon me. Allow me to ask, why am I called upon to speak here today? What have I or those I represent to do with your national independence? Are the great principles of political freedom and of natural justice embodied in that Declaration of Independence extended to us? Am I therefore called upon to bring our humble offering to the national altar and to confess the benefits and express devout gratitude for the blessings resulting from your independence to us? But such is not the state of the case. I say it with a sad sense of disparity between us. I am not included within the pale of this glorious anniversary. Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The blessings in which you this day rejoice are not enjoyed in common. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not me. The sunlight that brought light and healing to you has brought stripes and death to me. This 4th of July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice. I must mourn. To drag a man in fetters into the grand illuminated temple of liberty and call upon him to join you in joyous anthems were inhuman mockery and sacrilegious irony. Do you mean, citizens, to mock me by asking me to speak today? If so, there is a parallel to your conduct. And let me warn you that it is dangerous to copy the example of a nation whose crimes, towering up to heaven, were thrown down by the breath of the Almighty, burying that nation in irrevocable ruin. I can today take up the plaintive lament of a peeled and woe-smitten people. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down. Yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. We hung our harps upon the willows in the midst thereof. For there they that carried us away captive required of us a song, and they who wasted us required of us mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How can we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her cunning. If I do not remember thee, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. Fellow citizens, above your national tumultuous joy, I hear the mournful wail of millions whose chains, heavy and grievous yesterday, are today rendered more intolerable by the jubilee shouts that reach them. If I do forget, if I do not faithfully remember those bleeding children of sorrow this day, may my right hand forget her cunning, and may my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. To forget them, to pass lightly over their wrongs, and to chime in with the popular theme would be treason most scandalous and shocking, and would make me a reproach before God and the world. My subject, then, fellow citizens, is American slavery. I shall see this day and its popular characteristics from the slave's point of view. Standing here, identified with the American bondsman, making his wrongs mine, I do not hesitate to declare with all my soul that the character and conduct of this nation never looked blacker to me than on this 4th of July. Whether we turn to the declarations of the past or to the professions of the present, the conduct of the nation seems equally hideous and revolting. America is false to the past, false to the present, and solemnly binds herself to be false to the future. Standing with God and the crushed and bleeding slave of this occasion, I will, in the name of humanity, which is outraged, in the name of liberty, which is feathered, in the name of the Constitution and the Bible, which are disregarded and trampled upon, dare to call into question and to denounce with all the emphasis I can command everything that serves to perpetuate slavery. The great sin and shame of America. But I fancy I hear some of my audience say, it is just in this circumstance that you and your brother abolitionists failed to make a favorable impression on the public mind. Would you argue more and denounce less? Would you persuade more and rebuke less? Your cause would be much more likely to succeed. But I submit, where all is plain, there is nothing to be argued. What point in the anti-slavery creed would you have me argue? On what branch of the subject do the people of this country need light? Must I undertake to prove that the slave is a man? That point is conceded already. Nobody doubts it. The slaveholders themselves acknowledge it in the enactment of laws for their government. They acknowledge it when they punish disobedience on the part of the slave. There are 72 crimes in the state of Virginia which, if committed by a black man, no matter how ignorant he be, subject him to the punishment of death, while only 2 of the same crimes will subject a white man to the like punishment. What is this but the acknowledgement that the slave is a moral, intellectual, and responsible being? There is not a man beneath the canopy of heaven that does not know that slavery is wrong for him. What? Am I to argue that it is wrong to make men brutes, to rob them of their liberty, to work them without wages, to keep them ignorant of their relations to their fellow men, to beat them with sticks, to flay their flesh with the lash, to load their limbs with irons, to hunt them with dogs, to sell them at auction, to sunder their families, to knock out their teeth, to burn their flesh, to starve them into obedience and submission to their masters? Must I argue that a system thus marked with blood and stained with pollution is wrong? No, I will not. At a time like this, scorching irony, not convincing argument is needed. Oh, had I the ability and could reach the nation's ear, I would today pour out a fiery stream of biting ridicule, blasting reproach, withering sarcasm, and stern rebuke. For it is not light that is needed, but fire. It is not the gentle shower, but thunder. We need the storm, the whirlwind, and the earthquake. The feeling of the nation must be quickened, and the conscience of the nation must be roused. The propriety of the nation must be startled. The hypocrisy of the nation must be exposed, and its crimes against God and man must be proclaimed and denounced. What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all other days in the year the gross injustice and cruelty of which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham. Your boasted liberty and unholy license, your national greatness, swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless. Your denunciation of tyrants, brass-fronted impudence. Your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings with all your religious parade and solemnity are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, piety, and hypocrisy. A thin veil to cover up crimes which would disgrace a nation of savages. There is not a nation on the earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of the United States at this very hour. Go where you may, search where you will, roam through all the monarchies and despotisms of the old world. Travel through South America, search out every abuse, and when you have found the last, lay your facts by the side of the everyday practices of this nation. And you will say with me that for revolting barbarity and shameless hypocrisy, America reigns without a rival.
What to the slave is the 4th of July? The 4th of July oration of Frederick Douglass in 1852, given in Rochester, New York, read by Pacifica's Bernard White. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. And as we move into this Independence Day weekend, on Monday we'll hear excerpts of this address by James Earl Jones, part of our Howard Zinn event, many different actors, plus the great historian reading from People's History of the United States. That's Monday on Democracy Now! Today we turn to our own Juan Gonzalez, who recently gave a speech in Dallas, Texas, to media executives and Latino journalists in his role as the president of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. The media has become among the most powerful forces on earth, perhaps the most powerful weapon in the Pentagon's arsenal. Today, we're going to look at the role of media, racism, and third world journalists. This is Juan Gonzalez in Dallas, Texas.
So I'm not going to talk to you today simply about the need to hire and promote more Latino journalists, or even about the need to improve the news media's coverage of the nation's fast-growing Latino population. As we all know, that population now surpasses 38 million. Really, it's 42 million, if you include the nearly 4 million U.S. citizens of Puerto Rico, where I was born. You doubtless have heard numerous speeches before about the importance of a diverse newsroom, and most probably are in agreement, though the implementation of that goal continues to elude the executives of our industry, and I will try to touch a little bit on some of the reasons why. But I would like to devote the main part of my remarks today to questions that go far beyond the need for diversity, questions that go to the very heart of what we do every day, why you and I are in this profession, what our social role and our responsibility is to the American people, especially in turbulent and perilous times like the present. Why, in my opinion, The news media in our country are facing a growing crisis, how it got that way, and what we can do to make it better. We journalists rarely get the chance to step back for a moment and examine carefully the things that we do. We function, for the most part, as individual chroniclers of news events, even though our news organizations can only be successful through the cooperative work of hundreds and sometimes thousands of people. Newsroom culture tends to breed individual competition, to reward individual effort over group achievement, to cultivate the desire for celebrity status, especially in television news. The demand from our supervisors for practical day-to-day results, what have you done for me lately, usually dominates over the need for more in-depth analysis and long-range thinking. Thus, journalists have been habitually conditioned by newsroom culture not to be joiners of groups, and certainly not to delve too deeply into the world outside our own beat or our latest assignment. Nor do we receive sufficient on-the-job training, as has been documented by numerous media industry studies, to provide us a wider framework of thinking. Too many of us have become like thoroughbred horses, perpetually wearing blinders capable of fixing our sights only on the next big story. Too often we pay little attention to the world around us, even though the media companies that we employ, that employ us, have become such potent instruments for shaping the world's consciousness of itself, and even though we live in an age when information has become the most valuable of all commodities. In October of 2002, a few months after my election as NHJ president, our association's board of directors adopted a 5-year strategic plan. That plan was based in large measure on a preliminary analysis we performed of the state of our industry and of the Latino community. In adopting it, we tore off for the first time in our 20-year history as an organization the blinders of traditional newsroom culture. We ceased to regard our quest for newsroom diversity and for better coverage of Hispanics as something separate and apart from the broader challenges facing our industry. Let me just repeat two quotes from that plan's executive summary. In the introduction, we say, in an age when the free and rapid flow of information and news is critical to all sectors of our society, to the very preservation of our democratic life, the news media have evolved into more than just another private sector business. As principal gatekeeper to the public's information flow, our industry has become a powerful social institution in its own right, shaping the public's view of reality to the point that journalists are now respected and feared by the mightiest politician or celebrity, as well as by the lowliest citizen. And later on in that plan, we say, by adopting this plan, NAHJ is sending a signal to our colleagues in the industry that we will no longer sit by patiently while media companies reform at a snail-like pace. Rather, we will seek to increase both the speed and the quality of reform, whether that involves expanding employment and promotion opportunities for Latinos in the industry, improving the coverage of the Latino community, or elevating the study and practice of journalism and intervening in the key issues of concern to the news and information needs of all U.S. citizens. In that plan, and an executive summary of it is available on our website, nahj.org, for those of you who haven't seen it, we announced that we want to double the percentage of Latinos in the nation's newsrooms in 5 years. By 2008, we want to go from 4% in newspapers to 8%. And we want to go from what was 6% in television to 9.5%. We are setting a goal of doubling in 5 years what it took more than 25 years to achieve. Now, obviously, we had to develop a strategy for reaching those ambitious goals. So we came up with something we called the Parity Project, which attempts to identify the problem cities in America where Latinos are underrepresented vis-a-vis the circulation area of their papers and the demographics of their television markets, and to develop intensive and holistic programs in cooperation with the media companies and the Latino communities to change that rapidly. In less than a year since we launched the Parity Project, it is already operating in 7 cities, and we've already been able to document amazing results at some of the first papers. And it's already functioning in 3 cities here in Texas, Abilene, Wichita Falls, and San Angelo, in Naples, Florida, in Denver, Colorado, at the Rocky Mountain News, and at the Ventura County Star. We also set a bunch of other goals in response to the explosion of Spanish-language media. More Spanish language daily newspapers have been started during the past year than there have been daily newspapers in English started in the country in the past 10 years. And of course, this city is a perfect example with two new Spanish language dailies and a much watched newspaper war developing here that is very can only be healthy for the entire Latino community across the country. In fact, our board has just decided, but there is a need, but this is a wonderful development, but there is a need for professional development. There's a need for higher standards. There's a need for greater accountability of these new media to their communities. In fact, our board has just decided to commission a study that we will put out at Unity this year on the state of the Spanish language media in the United States. We're going to take a comprehensive look at what's happening and what it means for the Latino community. And this week, we're publishing the first ever style book specifically geared to journalists working in Spanish in the U.S. And we're planning more professional development training for our members and colleagues in the Spanish language media.
Juan Gonzalez, addressing a regional meeting of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists in Dallas. We'll be back with this address in a minute.
Say it's my country. Before they'd give in,
they'd rather fuss and fight
than say it's my country. I paid 300 years or more of slave driving sweat and welts on my back. This is my country.
This is my country, the impressions here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As we return to Democracy Now!, co-host Juan Gonzalez, president of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, recently addressing media executives and Latino journalists in Dallas.
Now, those of us who work in local broadcast news understand that the easiest thing to do is to cover crime, because all you have to do is go to the local police station. You've got policemen all over the city working for you, producing the results, and then picking the three or four that are going to be on the 6 o'clock news or the 5 o'clock news the next day. It's the easiest thing to do when you don't have the sufficient resources in your newsroom to actually go out and cover the community in a systematic way. Joseph Pulitzer, founder of one of the first newspaper chains, once wrote, "A journalist is the lookout on the bridge of the ship of state. He notes the passing sail, the little things of interest that dot the horizon in fine weather. He reports the drifting castaway whom the ship can save. He peers through fog and storm to give warning of dangers ahead. He is not thinking of his wages or the profits of his owners. He is there to watch over the safety and the welfare of the people who trust him." Pulitzer wasn't the only founder of a major newspaper chain to think that way. William Randolph Hearst and Edward Wiley Scripps, like Pulitzer, turned their newspapers into advocates for people who had no voice. E.W. Scripps once sent a memo to the editors of his various papers, and he had lots of them. He wrote, quote, "A newspaper must at all times antagonize the selfish interests of that very class which furnishes the larger part of the newspaper's income." Right. Scripps, Hearst, and Pulitzer directed their newspapers to the immigrant workers of the major cities, and they lowered the prices of their papers to get as many people reading them as possible. Hearst even published for many years in New York a German language daily newspaper that was very successful. Their papers in those days lived and died on circulation. They railed against the robber barons and the trusts of their day. They championed the issues of the little man. Of course, they changed dramatically over time as they got successful and bigger and more powerful. By the 1940s and the 50s, their newspapers moved from depending more on circulation for their income to depending on mass advertising. They no longer needed the reader as much. They needed a certain demographic of reader that the advertiser wanted to reach, but they ceased to be organs trying to inform the masses of the people and to represent their issues. Nonetheless, it is important to understand the origins of the newspaper industry in which we all work. Newspapers, after all, existed as early as colonial times. But during the early days of the press, and even in the beginning of the 1800s, the circulation of all newspapers was extremely small. Subscribing to them was so expensive that they principally served the needs of merchants and politicians for what we might today call business and political intelligence. In 1835, there were 7 daily newspapers in New York City with an average circulation of only 1,700 each. The largest, the Courier and Enquirer, sold just 4,000 copies. Each paper cost 6 pennies in those days, but you had to buy a year's subscription in advance, a sum that was out of the reach of any but the upper classes. Then along came a 22-year-old journeyman printer named Benjamin Day, who sparked the communications revolution in 1833 when he launched the New York Sun, the nation's first penny newspaper. Not only was Day's paper far cheaper than the competitors, but he hired young newsboys to hawk single copies of the Sun each day in the streets. That made it the first newspaper to be accessible in New York's growing class of artisans and workers. The paper was also dramatically different in style. Day pioneered crime reporting, crisply written feature stories, and coverage of sensational scandals. The Sun became a runaway success. Within 3 years, Day was selling 20,000 copies, and his paper boasted the largest circulation in the world. Soon others began imitating his approach. Day thus created the prototype of our modern mass newspaper. Of course, the 10% of New York's population that was comprised of free blacks was still virtually excluded from those papers. Newspapers saw little need to report on them except for stories about the continuing national conflict over slavery. That free black community may have been excluded, but it wasn't silenced. 6 years before Day began the New York Sun, 2 free black men in that city founded the nation's first black-owned newspaper. Their names were John Russworm and Reverend Samuel Cornish, and their paper was called Freedom's Journal. Speaking of the plight of African Americans in their founding issue, Cornish and Russworm wrote, quote, "We wish to plead our own cause. Too long have others spoken for us. From the press and the pulpit, we have suffered much by being incorrectly represented." Does that sound familiar? Yes. From the early days, newspapers misrepresented and distorted events and the role of racial minorities, Native Americans, African Americans, or Latinos. And they certainly didn't hire any to work in their newsrooms, except for that rare example like William Lloyd Garrison in his abolitionist newspaper, The Liberator, which often featured black writers like Frederick Douglass in its pages. But for the most part, these communities had to resort to individual, small African American, Native American, and Hispanic press, which emerged in a separate but parallel stream with the major media. Scores of black-owned newspapers operated throughout the 19th century. The first Spanish-language newspaper in the United States was in 1808, El Mississippi. In 1824, Cuban priest Felix Varela founded El Habanero in Philadelphia. And Spanish-language papers flourished in San Francisco, New York, the Southwest, and Florida. The Cherokee Phoenix, the first Native American newspaper in this country, was founded by Elias Boudinot in 1828 in northwest Georgia. Like El Mississippi, it was bilingual in English and Cherokee, using the recently developed 86-character alphabet developed by Sequoia. Once the Cherokee were forcibly removed from the southeast to the Oklahoma Territory, they founded the Cherokee Advocate, which published weekly from 1844 to 1906. Thus, there clearly existed a Hispanic, black, and Native American press from early on in this country, even before the white press, and in those days it really was a white press, had begun to spread to the European immigrant workers. There were always qualified minority journalists. They were just excluded from the dominant press by the prejudices born of slavery, Indian removal, and territorial expansion into the Mexican territories. This apartheid situation in the news media continued pretty much into the early 20th century, when some of the first blacks and Hispanics were hired to work on white newspapers. By mid-century, however, something else had happened. Newspapers ceased to be the main source of news and information, and you had the rise of radio and television. Newspapers obviously were never controlled by government. Thanks to the First Amendment, anybody could start a newspaper. Now, very few people could afford to buy the presses to publish a major newspaper, but pretty much anybody could start a little newspaper in this country. However, radio and television developed in a different way because the broadcasters had to transmit their signals over the public airwaves. And to prevent people from interfering with each other's signals, you had to have some control or some monitoring of the process. And besides, these were public airwaves they were using. So the government from the beginning began to regulate radio and television with the Radio Act of 1927 and the Federal Communications Act of 1934. And the government said, okay, we'll give you a free license to broadcast over the public airwaves. But in return, you have to give the public something back. You have to operate your radio station in the public interest, need, and convenience. So from the beginning, broadcasting was a regulated industry. And the broadcast owners would sometimes like us to forget that it is a regulated industry. And from the beginning, the government required certain things from the industry for those free licenses. They didn't sell it to you, remember. Until recently, they gave it to you. Gradually, by 1945, what the government meant by the public interest, need, and convenience began to be defined more clearly. There was a famous Supreme Court case in 1945, the Associated Press case. In that decision, the court defined the public interest as, quote, the widest possible dissemination of news and information from diverse and antagonistic viewpoints. So television and radio stations were required to have diversity of voices, diversity of perspectives in their broadcasts through court decisions and through federal law. In the early days of radio, the 1920s through the 1940s, minorities were once again excluded from the entire process, either as owners or reporters. Raul Cortez, the first Hispanic radio station owner, did not receive a license to operate his KCOR in San Antonio until 1946. 20 years after the birth of commercial radio. Before that, a handful of Mexican broadcasters had been allowed to buy time on Anglo-owned stations to broadcast Spanish programming, but not to own a station. The first black-owned radio station, Jesse Blayton's WERD in Atlanta, did not go on the air until 1949. It would take 14 more years until 1973 for the first black-owned television station, WGPR-TV in Detroit, a UHF station, to begin broadcasting. Now, I was already out of college before the first African-American owned a television station in this country. A few years before the first black and Hispanic-owned radio stations went on the air, Henry Lucy, the founder of the Time Life Empire, created a very important but nearly forgotten commission. It was called the Hutchins Commission, and he started it in 1944. It was composed of some of the finest minds of the post-war period, Reinhold Niebuhr, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., Archibald MacLeish. The Hutchins Commission was the first attempt to study the role of the mass media in American society. And as such, it is an important part of our history as journalists to understand. The Hutchins Commission developed what it called five standards that were the hallmarks of good journalism. I'm not going to get into all those standards. One in particular that is very important to our concerns. It was standard three. It said that the media had a responsibility for the projection of a representative picture of the constituent groups in the society. So as far back as 1947, when the Hutchins Commission report was published, American journalism was put on notice by what was admittedly a private but very important commission that the press had a responsibility to focus on projecting, quote, a representative picture of the constituent groups in the society. And the commission went on to say, quote, when the images they, the members of the press, portray fail to present the social group truly, they tend to pervert judgment. So the Hutchins Commission was an important step forward in helping to professionalize journalism in terms of the ideas we've all been taught about objectivity and balance and fairness, which have been the hallmarks of American journalism, at least in theory, if not in practice, since World War II. But despite the Hutchins Commission's newspapers remained virtually all white. And this clearly handicapped them when it came to portraying a representative group, a representative view of all society. The same was true of this same situation was true of television and radio, except that there the FCC, in its policies, openly promoted or ignored racial discrimination by their licensees. This is a part of American media history that is not generally known, but is very important for us to understand. In the 1950s, for instance, virtually every Southern affiliate of NBC refused to air the network's Nat King Cole Hour, forcing the cancellation of the show. Despite complaints from black television viewers, the FCC did nothing to sanction these Southern stations. True, in the news divisions of the national networks, which were then only beginning, there was some remarkable public service broadcasting during this period. It was the golden age of the television documentary, with shows like CBS Reports and NBC White Paper. Howard K. Smith, John Chancellor, Mike Wallace, Dan Rather, Peter Jennings all excelled as young reporters in their coverage of the civil rights battles in the South. But while the network sought to create a national consensus on the need to end Jim Crow apartheid in the South, local television and radio, still the heart and soul of broadcasting, were another matter. One of the most important battles over news media bias and democracy evolved over nearly two decades in the state of Mississippi, where the United Church of Christ and Dick Moore, the head of the church's Office of Communications, waged a pioneering campaign to force the FCC to integrate television in the South. A major focus of that battle was WLBT TV Channel 3 in Jackson, an NBC affiliate, and two radio stations owned by the same company in that town. From 1955 on, the church began to file complaints with the FCC about racist programming. While 45% of the population in that station's signal area was black, no blacks were employed at the station except for janitors, and they were rarely shown on television. In 1955, the NAACP complained that an NBC program featuring Thurgood Marshall, then the organization's general counsel, was deliberately cut off the air by WLBT, which substituted a sign saying, "Sorry, cable trouble." The station's owner later admitted in a news report that he had deliberately cut off the program. On September 10, 1962, the United States Supreme Court upheld the right of James Meredith to attend the all-white University of Mississippi. And I go through this history because we have a lot of members, especially in Spanish language media, who are recently here in the country. And we have many Latinos who are working in English language who, in their studies, didn't get this history. And it's important history to understand. The governor of Mississippi at the time, Ross Barnett, announced to a statewide television audience that there is no case in history where the Caucasian race has survived social integration. Barnett vowed that his state would, quote, not drink from the cup of genocide. This was the governor of Mississippi. He promptly appointed himself the university registrar, and 10 days later, he personally blocked Meredith's attempt to register at the Oxford, Mississippi campus of Ole Miss. Attorney General Robert Kennedy responded by sending in more than 500 federal agents on the evening of September 30th to escort Meredith onto campus. Within an hour, a mob of several thousand people formed and proceeded to attack the federal agents throughout the night with guns, bricks, bottles, and Molotov cocktails. The marshals, who were under orders not to shoot back, resisted only with tear gas. By the next morning, President Kennedy had to send in federal troops to disperse the attackers. By then, two people were dead, 28 marshals had been shot, and 160 had been injured. But while Governor Barnett and other segregationist Mississippi leaders were in part responsible for stoking the fears and hatreds of the mob, local broadcasters like WLBT played a pivotal role in fomenting the violence. As the FCC records show, for several days before the riots, the station broadcast a series of paid editorials by the Jackson White Citizens Council, urging local residents to support the governor and mobilize to resist the court order. But it broadcast no opposing views on this question. Despite many examples documented by the United Church of Christ of the station's bias, the FCC kept renewing its license, forcing the church to appeal the decision to the federal courts. The court battles lasted until 1969, when an appeals court in Washington, D.C. overturned the FCC and for the first time ordered a station's license revoked. In the process, the United Church of Christ court challenges established for all Americans the right of broadcast consumers to sue before the FCC over whether a station was fulfilling the public interest requirements of its license. So it was a pioneering case in that extent. But the WLBT was not an isolated case. For those of you who may be interested in looking at some of the others, there's the Southland Television Company case of 1955, where the FCC held the owner of segregated movie theaters had the character necessary to be issued a television construction permit because segregation laws were not inconsistent with the Communications Act. Or the Columbus Broadcasting Company decision of 1965, issuing only an admonishment to another Mississippi station that the FBI accused of fomenting riots in the Meredith, in the James Meredith situation. There's a Chapman television and radio case of 1970 holding that the co-owner of a segregated cemetery who covered it up, who covered up his policy, had the character for a broadcast license.
Juan Gonzalez addressing media executives and Latino journalists in Dallas, and we'll go back to the conclusion of his speech in a minute.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murdoch is Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen. The camera, the sword, buying coke, buying Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
And experience your psychic connection.
We don't have shit to say. We don't have anything to do.
What we want, what we need, what we want, what we need. But do we even know who plants the seed? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling proof. Flim-flam diagram, data jam, handicap, caught it. Yo, you bought it. A mind is a profitable thing to waste. You want another taste, baby? Got news good.
What we need to know.
News good.
What we want to know.
News good.
What we think we know.
Got remote control to choose a show. But the more we watch, the less we know. Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor.
News Goo, Polarity One, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, as we return to President of National Association of Hispanic Journalists, Juan Gonzalez, in Dallas.
So in commercial broadcasting, the FCC routinely provided licenses to known racists and people who practice segregation. Even in the colleges, in public radio, the same thing happened. Minorities were barred by many state laws in the South from colleges operating the only FCC licensed educational stations. For example, Arkansas State University's radio station, licensed by the FCC in 1957. The University of North Carolina's UNC-FM, licensed in 1952. KUT-FM of the University of Texas, licensed in 1958. These were all FM college stations licensed by the FCC at a time when these colleges admitted no blacks or minorities into the schools. The average sign-on years for stations in the 28 historically black colleges and universities was 1980, while the average sign-on year for the college stations licensed in predominantly white state colleges in those same states was 1970. That means that the college students who went to the white schools got a head start in learning broadcasting at those radio stations. The black students who went to the black colleges were set back 10 years on average just learning how to work at a radio station. And it is important to understand that radio was the precursor of television. Most television owners started out as radio owners in the beginning. NBC was a radio company before it was a television company. CBS was a radio company before it was a television company. And to the extent that the FCC prevented blacks and minorities from having access to radio licenses at the college level, whites had a huge head start in the broadcasting field and being able to be trained in broadcast journalism and then in actually developing the capacity to buy and own broadcast stations. This is a history that we as journalists are not aware of. So suddenly when we see that 1% of the 1,700 stations in the United States are owned by minorities, 1%, when minorities are 30% of the population, and we think that's because of lack of qualified folks to run them? You think it's bad at the reporter level? You think it's bad at the editor level? Try it at the owner level. At the ownership level, minorities are virtually excluded. 4% of the 12,000 radio stations in the United States are owned by minorities. 4%. 1% of the 1,700 television stations. And of course, while owners don't interfere on a daily basis in the working of any broadcast or journalistic organization, they have a huge say in who gets hired, especially at the top-level jobs. And when big questions come up, a presidential election, a war, or ethnic troubles in your own city, those owners have many ways, direct and indirect, to let you know how they want those major events covered. So when we talk about opportunities in journalism, we're not talking about just reporter jobs and editor jobs. We're talking about ultimately having the right and the opportunity to own newspaper and broadcast facilities, to be able to make the final decision on what it is that that newspaper or television station does in service to the public. Because there are several recent FCC studies commissioned by the FCC but never released to the public, which clearly show that minority-owned stations tend to provide more news and information of interest to minority listeners than white-owned stations. So this is the history of the FCC and the broadcast industry and the newspaper industry in their attempts to try to deal with or avoid dealing with diversity in their newsrooms. Nothing happened until the riots of the 1960s. Then in 1968, another commission was created, the Kerner Commission, or the U.S. Commission on Civil Disorders, appointed by President Johnson to examine the causes of violence and rioting in America. And that commission once again called on the journalists, particularly singled out the mass media, for its role and its problems in the coverage of these riots. And the Kerner Commission said, quote, "The absence of Negro faces and activity from the media has an effect on white audiences as well as blacks. If what the white American reads in newspapers and sees on television conditions his expectations of what is ordinary and normal in the larger society, he will neither understand nor accept the black American. By failing to portray the Negro as a matter of routine in the context of the total society, the news media, we believe, contributed to the black-white schism in this country." The Kerner Commission called for immediate steps to increase the number of minorities in newspapers and television, as well as in training programs. And it said, and this was the closing parts of its report, "Along with the country as a whole, the press has too long basked in a white world, looking out of it, if at all, with white men's eyes and a white perspective. That is no longer good enough. The painful process of readjustment that is required of the American news media must begin now. They must make a reality of integration in both their product and their personnel. They must insist on the highest standards of accuracy, not only reporting single events with care and skepticism, but placing each event in a meaningful perspective." Those were the words of a presidential commission more than 35 years ago. They echoed the Hutchins Commission of 20 years before that. So we're talking about for the past 50 years, this has been discussed. There's got to be diversity of viewpoint. The media must portray all groups in a society. They must provide meaning and context to the events they report. They must provide a forum for diverse views. And we're talking about 170 years that minority journalists have been working in this country. Even more remarkable is how little progress has been made. It was only after the Kerner Commission report that the organizations like the American Society of Newspaper Editors began to pay serious attention to integrating their newsrooms. It was only in 1978 that the FCC began to seriously develop new affirmative action programs to provide broadcast licenses to minorities. And over the next decade or so, the picture began to improve. But during the past decade or so, those affirmative action programs have been dismantled, and for the last few years, we have been going in the opposite direction. For the past 2 years, the percentage of minorities in television and radio have been declining, not increasing. For Hispanics, it's gone down from 10% 2 years ago to 6% this year. It's gone down in radio even faster. Radio news is disappearing. But it is especially disappearing when it comes to minorities. 2 years ago, 5% of the reporters in radio news were Hispanic. The next year, it went down to 2.5%. And this current year, it's down to 1%. There are virtually no Latinos doing news on radio. There are hardly any radio news reporters at all, but the disappearance is even greater among Latinos. Newspapers, meanwhile, have been creeping along with, but it's still only 4%, while our population, Latino population, is getting close to 14%. Television ownership. The number of television stations owned by minorities has gone down in the past 3 years from 33 to 20. That's largely because when the FCC adopted duopoly rules that a station could own two stations in one town, a lot of the minority-owned stations were bought up by the larger chains. So you have enormous drop in minority-owned stations. And, of course, I have to put a caveat in here because people will ask, what about Univision or the Telemundo networks? What about the explosion of Spanish-language media? Well, you all know that Telemundo is owned by NBC. And Univision is a distinct case. It has a lot of stations. It is a publicly held corporation. The minority shares of stock in Univision, or two big groups of such shares of stock, are held by the Cisneros Group out of Venezuela and the Televisa Group out of Mexico. It's a minority of the shares, and Univision does extremely important reporting and plays a major role, and one which I applaud. But in my opinion, and this is only my opinion because the NAHJ does not have a stand on this issue, Univision is not a Hispanic-owned company. It has overwhelmingly Hispanic employees, but to say that Mexican capital or Venezuelan capital can be substituted for Hispanic-American capital is like saying that Australians or Canadians or Brits who own a company in the United States because they speak English are Americans. We're talking about Hispanic Americans, of which there are 38 million in this country. Hispanic Americans don't own Univision. They don't own the majority of shares in the stock of the company. They don't own they don't have a majority of the board of directors. They have neither ownership nor control over Univision. Now, again, that doesn't mean that Univision is not doing an important job. And it is spreading Spanish language media and doing a very good job of it. But ownership and control are different from just working at a company. And that's the difference in terms of Univision. We're not only going backward or a stagnant when it comes to diversity in media ownership. Media ownership concentration, loosening of public service restrictions on broadcasting, excessive emphasis on the highest possible rates of return for investors, all of these trends have converged. Media companies like convergence, right? They've converged into an enormous force propelling our industry more and more toward infotainment, celebrity news, disconnected fragments of information, less content, less in-depth reporting, less investigative reporting, less diversity of viewpoint in newspapers and on television. Think of how much more complex the world is today than it was in 1947 or in 1968. How much more information and news the public needs to be able to function intelligently from day to day, yet how much less of that valuable information as opposed to entertainment it is currently receiving. So what do we do with all this? Well, first of all, we have to have a cogent and systematic analysis of the state of our industry and how its principal weaknesses have developed. If we don't understand the causes of a problem, we have little chance of solving it. The great weakness of all past efforts to achieve newsroom diversity by the many well-meaning organizations, individuals, and companies is that they have not analyzed the history of our industry. We also must be honest and admit to ourselves that we haven't been able to figure out the proper relationship between operating a private business and serving the public good and what that means. And increasingly, as our media companies become parts of larger conglomerates, where the news divisions are only a tiny portion of the overall entertainment operation, finding the proper relationship becomes even harder. ABC News provides perhaps 2% of the profit of the Disney company, even less if Comcast takes over. NBC provides less than 2% of the profits of the General Electric company. Time Life used to get all of its income from journalism or news. Now with AOL and Warner Cable, Time Warner Cable and the record business and the movie business, the news division is only a minor part of the company. So as these corporations get bigger and bigger, as they get more powerful, as they get further away from their local roots, the question is how will they serve the public good while at the same time maintaining their desire for maximum profit level? And what will we, the Latino journalists, because we are the future, along with African-American and Native American and Asian-American journalists, what will we do? By 2050, most of you in this room are younger than I, so you'll be around then. 50% of the people living in the United States will trace their origins back to Asia, Africa, or Latin America. There will be a majority, a huge demographic change in the United States. I've just given you a quick history of the last 170 years. But in another 50 years, the nation will be completely changed. The people who provide the news will change as well. The question is, what kind of industry will we inherit? Will we become accomplices to continued degradation of quality in journalism and news, or will we insist on better quality? Do we want a bigger share of a rotten pie, or do we want a bigger share of a fresh and healthy pie? If you want a bigger share of a rotten pie, then you and I disagree. That's not why I got into journalism, and we'll have to continue to disagree on that. But if you believe, as Pulitzer believed, as Haywood Bruin believed, and Edward R. Murrow believed, and Frank Del Olmos believed, as Ben Bagdikian, Walter Cronkite, and Bill Moyers believe, as many of the finest minds that have ever graced our profession believe, that journalism serves a critical public function in this society, then you have to join organizations like NAHJ and NABJ and the Committee of Concerned Journalists. And you have to wake up the Society of Professional Journalists and ASNI and RTNDA. You have to stand up in your newsroom. You have to insist on quality. You have to insist on public accountability by the news media to the public that we serve. And you have to fight for diversity of ownership because competition is critical. Albert Camus, in one of his novels, I don't recall right now if it was The Plague or The Stranger, had a phrase that has always stuck in my mind. He said, "I sometimes think that if a man were forced to live the rest of his life upside down in the trunk of a tree, he would get used to it." We have now gotten used to the fact that there are newspaper monopolies in most of the cities in the United States. And all of us who are journalists know that if you don't have competition, your quality goes down. You no longer have to compete and show that you're better because you're the only show in town. So we've gotten used to this irrational situation that for daily newspapers, for the most part, there is no competition other than TV or radio. And if Michael Powell and the FCC have their way, we will move in the same direction in local television and broadcasting as well. So I just want to tell you that we have a lot of work to do. At the NEHJ, we are directing ourselves to a much broader view of what it is we're going to have to do to achieve diversity, to have real substantive change. Those of you who haven't joined NEHJ, I urge you to do so, because we're setting the pace and we're setting the direction and we're challenging not just the other minority journalism organizations, but all journalism organizations in this country to stand up, not just for diversity, because diversity is only a means to a greater good, better journalism for the American people. Joseph Pulitzer warned nearly a century ago, and I'll leave you with these words of his, "Our republic and its press will rise or fall together. An able, disinterested, public-spirited press with trained intelligence to know the right and courage to do it can preserve the public virtue without which popular government is a sham and a mockery. A cynical, mercenary, demagogic press will produce in time a people as base as itself." I know that there are thousands of talented and dedicated journalists in this country who try each day to do their best and who often produce marvelous reporting, but too many have grown frustrated and disheartened by the cheapening of our profession through infotainment. We can change that, but we must first resolve to do it.
Juan Gonzalez, president of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists and co-host here on Democracy Now!, addressing media executives and Latino journalists in Dallas, Texas. His website is www.nahj.org. And if you'd like to get a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. That does it for today's program. Speaking of the media, today at 12:30, just afternoon, I'll be at the ACME Coalition Summit. That's the Action Coalition for Media Education in San Francisco, University of San Francisco McLaren Center. Also, Friday night, tonight at 7 p.m. at a KZYX benefit in Boonville, California, Mendocino County Fairgrounds. On Saturday in Cleveland, Ohio at 4:30. You can go to our website for more details. On the 7th of July at Exit Art in New York, and then we celebrate Tampa, the both TV and radio, that is WMNF, Tampa Radio, and Tampa Bay Speak Up Public Access TV. Very much looking forward to go to that. Go to our website at democracynow.org for more information. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdo-Kadous, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill, Nell Geiser, Alpa Patel, Mike DeFilippo, and Rich Kim are our engineers. Again, for more information, go to our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us. Estás ambitada.